This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Mara Verheiden Hilliard joins us to share an on-the-ground perspective of what's happening on college campuses around the nation.
She's one of the leading litigators in defending protesters and winning numerous lawsuits.
We're also joined by Eleanor Stein, who was on campus at Columbia University during the 1968 protests.
Eleanor Stein is a terrific attorney in her own right, a friend of Michael Ratner's when they were both there in 68, and she's got a good memory.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. During the Occupy Wall Street protests of late 2011 and early 2012, the FBI treated the movement as a domestic terrorist threat. That was even though the Bureau acknowledged that organizers were calling for peaceful protests. Massive resources were deployed to track the movement, and FBI and counterterrorism agents around the country coordinated with local and federal law enforcement to track and gather intelligence, effectively serving as an arm for private business. Now, more than a decade later, college administrators are calling local armed police, some in riot gear, to arrest and in many instances brutalize hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters in actions and encampments that are sweeping the nation. More than 1,000 protesters have been arrested over the last 2 weeks on campuses in states including Texas, Utah, Virginia, North Carolina, New Mexico, Connecticut, Louisiana, California, and New Jersey. At UCLA last week, after pro-Israel supporters, carrying symbols of radical Jewish groups, not of student age, allegedly threw fireworks into a solidarity encampment, students defending the camp were attacked with stones and sticks. Yet after an hour of violence, police standing nearby and watching failed to intervene. Joining us to discuss these ongoing developments is attorney Mara Verheiden Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund and its Center for Protest Law and Litigation in Washington, D.C. Mara is one of the country's top litigators defending protesters and winning several reforms in police practices at mass assemblies and demonstrations. Mara Verheiden Hilliard, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mara, as you know, back in the 1960s, city police were called in on many college campuses to intervene during protests. And that led to brutalization and, in some cases, even death of student protesters. Now, as a result of that, nearly every college campus has its own police force. Why, then, are local law enforcement agencies being called on to deal with the rash of campus protests?
Well, universities across the United States are demonstrating their true colors when it comes to academic freedom and free speech, all the things that they talk to their students about in their classes, but then in practice, they're crushing student demonstrations, peaceful protesters demanding divestment from genocide and apartheid. And they are unleashing their municipality police departments to use the force of the state, to use the force of the municipalities to bring in police who are armed, who have guns, who have stun grenades, who have handcuffs, so that they can take students out of these peaceful encampments and take them into custody and crush the protests. And we're seeing a massive wave of that right now.
Mara, in last week's UCLA case, police stood by for an hour as pro-Israeli factions threw stones, sticks, and fireworks into a peaceful encampment. What does this say to you?
Well, the UCLA police stood there while a fascist Zionist mob physically attacked the protesters, beating them with rods, with bats, in an extremely violent attack that went on for an hour or more, and they did nothing. And then they called in the LAPD to arrest the victims of these attacks and to violently take them into custody. And it says a lot about the university. In fact, even after the violent attack on their own students, the university came out basically condemning the students. That was their first reaction, was to condemn the victims of the attack. The level of political hostility towards pro-Palestine, anti-genocide, anti-apartheid students demanding that their universities divest is extraordinary, and the university presidents should be ashamed. It is really heartening, though, that a lot of faculty have stood with the students and themselves have been brutalized and arrested.
Now, Mara, some people have drawn the comparison of the nationwide surge of pro-Palestinian protests to the Occupy movement. And you were very involved in defending occupiers and uncovered evidence of both FBI and Department of Homeland Security monitoring of that movement. Do you think the same kind of federal monitoring of these protests is underway?
I think it is certainly underway. Given the fact that the political nature of the demands of the students, the divestment from apartheid and from genocide, the condemnation of Zionism, this is a deeply political issue that many in power in the United States oppose. And we have, over the years, seen the FBI regularly target those demanding self-determination for the Palestinian people. So we would certainly expect that that is occurring right now.
Attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, what advice do you give to students who are deciding how active to be in school protests?
I think the same advice that we give everyone, which is to really look at who you want to be, who you want to be able to tell people you were. You want to be that person that's saying, oh, you know, these amazing things that changed our society for the better occurred, but I was never part of them. To follow your own conscience, to follow what you believe in, but to be also very mindful of what you are doing, what your risks are, to be able to make choices that you believe in and that you are comfortable with, to be as well-informed as possible about what you're doing. But we absolutely support the right of people and encourage people and students to stand up for what they believe in. That is why we have our organization, the Center for Protest Law and Litigation, at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, because we recognize that all change in history has occurred because of the movement of the people, because of the willingness of people to stand up collectively for what they believe in. And we think that these students are so brave for what they are doing, for what they have been willing to do, because they believe so deeply in the cause of justice, of liberation, and against this vicious genocidal war that has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians.
And we want to ask you in a moment about the Center for Protest Law and Litigation. But Mara, you've alluded to the hypocrisy in universities touting support for free expression, but on the other hand, demonstrating to the world that they're actually limiting that. Can you comment briefly on the rise and contrast for us the increased crackdowns on free speech on campus, but at the same time, the erection of things like Cop City in Georgia, training facilities that I think may be replicated elsewhere in the country to really increasingly militarize our police forces?
There is obviously has been a growing militarization of police agencies. I mean, police agencies have always acted as an occupying force against oppressed communities throughout the United States. And with every advancing year and every advancing technology, they grow in both strength and capacity and use of technologies, including military technologies that are deployed throughout American police forces to use against a civilian population. The training facility that so many people have stood up against in Atlanta is intended to train police in basically urban warfare. And that means that you are training police in how to basically conduct police combat operations against people living in urban environments throughout the United States. It is extremely dangerous that police are basically being trained and given a green light to look at the civilian population almost like enemy combatants in that way. And we and so many others, are deeply opposed to these kind of efforts. It is incredibly dangerous. And you see what the NYPD has been doing in New York. I mean, the NYPD is larger than half of the world's countries' militaries. And here they have been called in against students at university after university, after college after college. I mean, basically, they're marching their way through New York City, grabbing students, arresting them at the request of these students' own universities. And they've been brutal in these arrests. They're taking protesters, out of these encampments. And meanwhile, this is their great crime-fighting effort, is students who are standing up for what they believe in, who are engaged in protests and encampments. That's what we're seeing.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Heidi Bogosian. We're speaking with Attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. Mara, you've been on site at several recent demonstrations. Given your decades of legal work defending protesters and holding police accountable, what are your observations of the new dynamics between police and demonstrators?
I think in many ways the dynamics don't change. Demonstrations take to the street historically in the United States. They are frequently and often historically met with repression by the police. But the fact that, as it says, the people will not be moved, the fact that even with extreme repression, when you look at the long arc, people always fight forwards towards liberation and continue the struggle. We've seen different tactics being deployed at different protests in different cities across the United States against demonstrators. And we've seen shifting tactics. We've seen efforts to, in New York, grab leaders and organizers and try and, in fact, arrest them, peaceful leaders and organizers targeting them out of demonstrations on the streets, again, by the NYPD. And in, other localities and other places, different actions by the police to try and suppress demonstrations at different points. These are the same things that we always see with every wave of social justice organizing and street protests in the United States. And historically, you can see that people have never stopped protesting and they never will.
What is the state of different viewpoint tolerance on U.S. college campuses? Are things getting more conservative?
I think what's happening right now is an interesting confluence where, what would be considered traditionally the purview of the, quote unquote, right wing to attack demonstrators who are basically anti-war demonstrators is also being embraced by many in the Democratic Party side of politics. And this is because of the strength of demands from Zionists who seek to demonize and crush student protests. The complete hypocrisy of this has become very paramount because, this has been supported by the New York Times and other newspapers with really false headlines decrying the protests as anti-Semitic when there are so many Jewish students who are part of the protests, who are organizing the protests, who are with their sisters and brothers, who are Arab and Muslim and Palestinian and others from all backgrounds. These are so plainly not, the demand of anti-Zionism is so plainly not anti-Semitism. And yet, you still see these constant messages being pushed. Congress last week has passed a resolution that would seek to shut down any anti-Zionist commentary on college campuses. And this was supported not just by the right wing, but by Democrats. This is a complete violation of fundamental First Amendment rights that you cannot criticize Israel and Israel's conduct. It says so much about where we are right now.
Are you seeing a chilling effect on people who want to protest but fear law enforcement violence?
Take a look at the streets. I would say that the students who are so brave have really shown the way. And yes, of course, this has to have some chilling effect on people who might otherwise think, can I do this? What am I risking? It always does have a chilling effect, but there's also going to be so many people who believe in their hearts that they cannot be silent with a U.S.-backed genocide. When you have U.S. weapons, billions of dollars funding this brutal, brutal campaign that is killing and murdering tens of thousands of people and children and dismembering them, and knowing that it is your government of the United States that is funding this, knowing that it is your universities who are invested in ways that support this activity, these young people are speaking up and speaking up proudly and with a conscience because they are not going to be silent in the face of this.
Mara, we haven't had you on Law and Disorder in a couple of years. Can you speak generally to any changes that you've observed at demonstrations and mass assemblies in general? Any change in police tactics? I mean, we know, for example, that laws around the country in some places are trying to criminalize protests, but are police still using less lethals and other violent munitions?
Yes, they are. In fact, we're litigating against the District of Columbia Metropolitan Police Department for its use of so-called less lethals against racial justice protesters. And in particular, we're among various issues focusing on their use of what are stinger grenades. These are explosive grenades that are thrown into crowds of protesters that break open with more than 100 pieces of shrapnel that go in all directions indiscriminately that shred into people's legs. They are part and parcel of a stun grenade that can have and is intended to have sound and light to disorient people. So there you are protesting. You haven't done anything unlawful, and suddenly you are in the midst of these like grenade explosions. I mean, this is like warfare against people engaged in protest and First Amendment activity. And so we're fighting to try and stop the use of those weapons on behalf of people who've been injured by them. And all over the country, there are a lot of amazing civil rights lawyers and legal organizations who have brought and are bringing similar lawsuits to try and strip the police of using these military, paramilitary-type weapons against protesters.
Do you think police violence will escalate on campuses? And if so, what kind of lawsuits might we see against college administrators?
Well, over this past week, we've seen what feels like a coordinated crackdown of police violence on campus after campus, from coast to coast, north and south, with demonstrators being attacked by the police, with a lot of violence against student protesters, that again is supported by their own universities, this level of violence against them. And I would certainly imagine that in the aftermath of this, civil rights lawyers and legal organizations will be looking at Section 1983 claims for this violence against student protesters. But we're also seeing a lot of other attacks on students, including summary suspensions, where students are being immediately suspended from campus, being kicked out of their dorm rooms, being deprived of access to food, no place to stay, not being able to finish off their school years. And this is being done before there's even a hearing. And this is being done against demonstrators who are not accused of any violent conduct, simply of protesting on campus. This has happened at Columbia and at Barnard. It's happening now to George Washington University students who are subject to this. And it is completely violative of any concept of due process. It just turns due process on its head to take students and give them no process, no hearing before the punishment. It's like pre-hearing punishment. And it's clearly intended to intimidate and silence and punish these demonstrators who are standing up against genocide and who are demanding that their universities divest from genocide.
Mara, I may have read the news incorrectly. I thought I read that George Washington University asked the police to come and they refused, along with the mayor of D.C. Is that accurate?
The GW University wanted to clear their yard of peaceful protesters right away. And the command officials and the mayor's office in the District of Columbia decided not to do that. That decision would be in accord with laws that, you know, have been put in place as a result of lawsuits that we've brought over the years against the Metropolitan Police Department, laws that state that the policy of the District of Columbia is to support and allow peaceful protest on its, you know, streets, sidewalks, and parklands. The GW space is private property, but the encampment also flows into District of Columbia jurisdiction on H Street. So now we have the right-wing extremists in Congress, some of whom are completely funded by, in their initial campaigns, like Tom Cotton, by AIPAC, demanding that the mayor and the police appear in front of Congress so they can question them as to why they're not clearing this peaceful encampment, because it always bears reminding that the District of Columbia, in which we are in, is still a colony.
You mentioned one case that you're working on. Can you tell us more about the Center for Protest Law and Litigation and, in general, the kind of work you do there?
The Center for Protest Law and Litigation is a project of our organization, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. And we have for more than, well, for about 30 years now, among a lot of our work is focused on defending movements for justice across the United States. And we launched the Center for Protest Law and Litigation to really focus that particular area of our work, which is a primary and dominant area of what we do, and to really name it and create a structure to identify and support that work. We have offices that are anchored in Washington, D.C., and also in the Bay Area, where our work in the Bay Area has been defending the student protesters, the Bay Bridge 78, and so many others who have been fighting against genocide and apartheid over these last months. And that programmatic work is really essential to the larger organizational work.
Mara, this has been a very enlightening interview. Thank you for being on Law and Disorder. Can you tell us about anything else you'd like to mention before we have to say goodbye?
I really urge people all over the country who are listening to this, if they are not themselves in the streets, in the encampments, to do everything they can to support these students. The students have taken great risk. They are being penalized by the universities. Some of them are going to be facing criminal charges. Others of them, even if they aren't facing criminal charges, are facing significant repercussions at the university, including these suspensions and upcoming disciplinary hearings. There is a strong need for attorneys who can provide support to this, and anyone who's interested in getting involved, they should feel free to reach out to us at the Center for Protest Law and Litigation. And you also can see what these campuses now look like. When Columbia called in the NYPD, which was chomping at the bit to grab these students in case, in some of these instances quite violently, and to arrest them, you know, they refused to allow, the NYPD refused to allow the press on campus while they conducted this arrest of the students. And then they themselves put out these appalling videos of them, like, raising the American flag tearing down Palestinian flags. I mean, just really demonstrating the eagerness and political hostility that they have to the demonstrators. And then Columbia asked the NYPD, again, larger than the military of half of the countries in the world, to occupy the campus for the next 2 weeks. So now Columbia University is occupied by the NYPD in order to suppress any pro-Palestinian dissent. This is demonstrative of the university's views of their students. They're actually now they're shutting down commencements, they're shutting down speakers, they have canceled speakers across the country like USC. They're doing everything they can to stop people from being able to express themselves, including inviting in paramilitary police forces to become occupying forces on their campuses. That's the state of American universities and academic freedom and free speech. They can teach what they want in the classroom, but the reality is what we're seeing in the street.
Mara, we're so glad that the protesters around the country have you on their side. Thanks for your important work.
Thank you for having me.
Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, thank you so much for being our guest on Law & Disorder. You take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well, of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized.
One of the great events of the 60s was the Columbia student takeover of several buildings on their campus, protesting the university's complicity in the war against the Vietnamese people, and their racist action in building a gym in a public park in Harlem adjacent to Columbia. The student actions at Columbia brought down a terrific repression. 700 students were arrested and beaten in May of 1968. Our own Michael Ratner, a co-founder of Law & Disorder and a law student at Columbia at the time, was also beaten by the police. For Michael, there was no turning back. He went on to become one of the great movement lawyers of his generation. We speak today with his friend and Columbia University student, anti-war Vietnam activist Eleanor Stein. Like Michael, she was at the law school. Eleanor Stein went on to become an attorney and a law professor in Albany, specializing in climate law. We will be speaking with her on the similarities between the repression at Columbia 56 years ago and the current repression. Eleanor Stein, a hearty, warm welcome back to Law & Disorder.
It's so good to be here. Thank you.
Eleanor, what brought you into the anti-war movement at Columbia in 1968?
It's hard to conjure up those months and that year for people who didn't live through it, but 1968 was the high tide of the Vietnam War. In 1967, over 9,000 Americans had been killed, and of course hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese. And in 1968, that number would almost double to over 15,000. And in January of that year was the Tet Offensive, where the Vietnamese, who were fighting to get rid of the Americans and take over their own country and their own government, took over dozens of provincial capitals and many other towns and cities in Vietnam, including the American embassy for quite a while. And at home, it was May 4th, 1968, that Martin Luther King was assassinated. And cities all over the country, every inner city exploded in rebellion in African-American communities. And tanks were rolling down the streets of Washington, D.C. So it's just a reminder of what the context was for us at that moment. And I was a first-year law student at Columbia. I was sitting in contracts class with my best friend, Gus Reichbach, who we'll be talking about. We heard people chanting outside. And Gussie said, "Hey, let's get out of here." We left. We ran outside. And the Students for Democratic Society and Students African American Society were staging a march over from the campus to the site of what was supposed to be an exclusive gymnasium for the youth of Columbia only, that was going to be located in Morningside Park, one of probably the largest open green space in Harlem. So our protest against that was, we had signs that said "Stop Jim Crow," but it was G-Y-M Crow. And people marched over to the gym site and were chanting, and then somebody climbed over the fence and sat down in front of the bulldozers, and we were off.
Now, Eleanor, Columbia students also took over several buildings on the campus those 56 years ago. They occupied the Lowe Memorial Library, where the president's office is located, and also Hamilton Hall, which they lately have occupied. What were the demands and the issues at the heart of this?
You know, the issues at the heart of it were the great moral issues of the day, just like today. One of the issues was stopping the construction of the gym, which was clearly seen as a racist enterprise. There was going to be a back door down at the bottom of the hill. Morningside Park, for those who don't know, is a steep hill. Harlem's at the bottom. Columbia, symbolically, is at the top. And it was going to be exclusive for Columbia youth, but there was going to be a back door where members of the community could use, you know, occasionally. So one of the demands was stop the construction of the gym. The second demand was linked to the Vietnam War. There was an institution on campus called the Institute for Defense Analysis, which was a Department of Defense contractor that entered into agreements with universities and others to do research and do studies and scientific work for the war effort. And once we found out that the war was actually there in our campus, that our university was complicit in the Vietnam War, we focused on that target. And the specific demand was get the IDA, the Institute for Defense Analysis, off the campus and stop the construction of the gym. Those are the core demands. And then, of course, as the demonstrations escalated, we, as students are doing today, we added the demand for amnesty, that protesters not be penalized for their participation in the protests.
Yes. There was a massive crackdown at Columbia in 1968. How is this repression similar to what's happened lately at Columbia?
Well, it's amazing to watch this. It's so much like going back to one's youth. So in 1968, there were about 750 students arrested. About 150 were sent to the hospital. The weapon of choice at that time was the old-fashioned billy club, and a lot of students were beaten. Our friend Gus Reichbach was badly beaten in the head, was concussed. Many other students were beaten. There's many pictures of students with blood pouring down their faces. And then the university pursued disciplinary action against students who had been arrested, and especially the leadership. So today, I think it was roughly 200 to 230 students were arrested, ironically, on the very same day, April 30th, 56 years later. And my impression is that the police used concussive grenades in the buildings to kind of scare everybody and, you know, subdue the students. But I think the students, as far as I can tell, they certainly didn't do anything to provoke that kind of violence and that kind of repression. As I understand it, they, and as we all saw on television, they simply walked out of the building in a very disciplined way, handcuffed with zip ties behind their backs, which apparently people had to, were kept in zip ties for 7 or 8 hours, a very painful and dangerous procedure.
Eleanor, how is Columbia President Shafeek and its board of trustees complicit in today's assault on Gaza? I know that neither she nor any other college president across the country has condemned Israel's bombing of every single university in Gaza.
So glad that you raised that issue. I think it's really central, although it you don't see it in the press. You hear it on Democracy Now! You hear it on this show. But I know Naomi Klein and I think others are calling this scholasticide in Gaza. Every university has been reduced to rubble. Thousands and thousands of students have been killed. Schools have been destroyed. Museums have been destroyed. Archives have been destroyed. Really hundreds, maybe thousands of years of history of the Palestinian people is being obliterated, as well as, of course, you know, 35,000 people. But the systematic and clearly intentional and planned destruction of the educational infrastructure of Gaza is in itself is a war crime of its own, the destruction of a people's history and culture. And the students are raising this, scholasticide, students are raising this, but I have not seen university administrators, university trustees, university presidents expressing any sense of responsibility or empathy or concern even for their colleagues in Gaza. So I think that has contributed to the sense of the students that they are, it's up to them. And I think we are all seeing that it is indeed up to them, that they are up to that challenge.
Eleanor Stein, the Board of Trustees at Columbia is made up of very rich people. It's been observed that the president of the university takes its orders from them. Do you agree?
Well, I think that's generally true, and I think the trustees are a factor. I think the finances of the university, and we don't know really the extent to which either Israeli forces or pro-Zionist forces are, or foundations, or governmental support. We don't know the extent to which it's embedded in the life of Columbia, but I have a feeling that it's greatly and deeply embedded. And, of course, President Shafeek herself is apparently pulling down a very healthy salary, somewhere in the millions, so much so that her former colleagues in the British House of Lords were shocked and astonished to hear what her salary was going to be to go to Columbia. But more broadly, I remember in 1968, NACLA, North American Congress on Latin America, put out what I think was one of its very first reports, which was called Who Rules Columbia? And to this day, it's a classic of kind of root cause analysis. And it tracks major corporations, major foundations, other entities that were central to the running of Columbia. I think there were media conglomerates central to the running of Columbia. So it really painted the classic picture of the kind of octopus tentacles of corporate America running and dictating policy to this university. And I think if so, I know that people are doing that research today, I'm sure they have done it, and I think we're going to see a very similar pattern.
Eleanor, in your opinion, did the repression of Columbia students back in 68, especially by law enforcement, backfire? And what do you think the result of the current nationally courted crackdown will be?
You know, when we were in the buildings, and I'll just clarify, the first building that was occupied in 1968 was Hamilton Hall, as today, which is a classroom building. And it was held by the Student Afro-American Society. And then the white students left and took over eventually four other buildings, three classroom buildings, and one administration building, low library. And in the 7 days that we held those five buildings, and by the way, flew red flags from the roof of every one of them, a truly stirring sight. The campus was split. There were a lot of students who supported us. There were a lot of students who were very annoyed and angry and resentful that they're, you know, it's the end of the semester, it was the spring. Where was their chance to play Frisbee on the campus? And where was their chance to finish out their classes? And so there were a lot of students who might, there were students who were kind of neutral. They agreed with our aims, but they thought we had gone a little far, and they didn't like being locked out of their classes. And then, of course, there was an organized right-wing opposition in which the athletic students, as we call them, the jocks, played a leading role, and they maintained a kind of a cordon around the occupied buildings to prevent people from coming in and out, to prevent people from bringing us food and communications. And the faculty was, I'd say, on the whole, rather neutral. There were a handful. Eric Foner had just started his academic career. He was very supportive. There was a handful who were supportive, and many were opposed. However, once police came on campus on April 30th, 1968, and dragged the students out, and media was not banned from the campus. They learned that lesson. Later, widely seen, widely televised, the sentiment on campus changed dramatically, and the level of support for the students became almost universal. And there was actually a general strike of students and university employees after the bust in support of the students. And it was impossible for the university to go on functioning. And they didn't function. They basically closed. Everyone, you know, became pass-fail. Exams were canceled. I think graduation was moved indoors, but I think it was kind of a fiasco. Our mutual dear friend Michael Ratner ended up graduating first in his class, partly because the last semester of his stay there was pass-fail, so he didn't even have to do any work. I teased him about that till the end of his life. So I think the same thing is happening now. And the revulsion of students and the revulsion of faculty at having their campus, basically their campus is now under occupation by the police. Thousands and thousands of police, and they're going to stay there, the president announced, until May 17th, which is actually after graduation. So they're now living in occupied territory, and I don't think they like it one bit. So I think the tide of public opinion in the university, and I think we're seeing this everywhere, has changed dramatically because of the incursion of the police.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Heidi Boghossian, and we're speaking with law professor Eleanor Stein, who's a veteran of the Columbia sit-down and student strike back in 1968. Eleanor, Columbia President Shafiq called in the New York Police Department for a second time. She'd been collaborating with the FBI. On April 30th, police in riot gear arrived at the Columbia campus. How do you appreciate the fact that she wrote a letter requesting that they break up the encampment? In the letter, she said that the university had been vandalized and she was protecting the students and their right to free speech. How do you appreciate that?
I would say that it's basically a pack of lies, in a word. You know, to me, the discipline and care of the students in that encampment, and I think this is generally true across the country, and I've seen it on other campuses myself, in the last few weeks is remarkable and is really praiseworthy in the face of tremendous provocation by the university and by students and others who are supporting the Zionist genocide in Gaza. The most ironic thing in her letter is that she says she's trying to protect the students and trying to protect their right to free speech. So just to be clear, weeks ago, after completely peaceful demonstrations and rallies on the campus, Columbia banned two organizations, two of the leading organizations in support of Gaza, Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. She banned them from the campus. And you would see on the campus, there would be one table in the middle of the campus with one person holding up a photograph of an Israeli baby and a sign about October 7th. And that was the only voice that was allowed on the campus. And the idea that she's protecting free speech is, it's really breathtaking in its duplicity. I can't remember anything comparable to this. They were not being banned because they had broken any of the multitude of university rules or laws. They were banned because they were supporting the Palestinians. And that speech was banned on the campus. And I will say, Columbia was not alone. I gave a talk at NYU in November on climate change, which is my field, and I asked to be introduced as a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, just as a way to say, let's not forget this is happening. And I actually was speaking about the relationship between climate change and the incursion in Gaza. And two representatives of the law school came to see me. They literally took me into the proverbial back room and said, you can't say that on this campus. NYU has banned those words, and it has banned any discussion of Israel and Palestine. And I was really astonished. I mean, I knew they didn't like it. I knew what side they were on, but I was really astonished. How can a law school ban? Is it the word Jewish? Is it the word voice? Maybe it's the word peace. That was so terrifying. So to me, that just exemplified what Columbia, NYU, and many other universities are doing, which is they will go to any lengths to prevent an open discussion on the merits of what Israel is doing. And I think that's her protecting the right to free speech. So I think that the best thing I can say is that what she did has really alienated not only the student body, but the faculty, which is now up in arms against her leadership.
Eleanor, at the George Washington University campus, which is just a few blocks from the White House, the campus president asked the local D.C. police to come on campus and break up their encampment. But to their credit, the top brass at the police department and the mayor of D.C. refused. What do you make of that?
I appreciate what they did enormously, and it's very unusual. But I will say even the New York Police Department, after the first round of arrests at Columbia, did make a statement saying that they didn't see any reason for these arrests. Students were not breaking any laws. They didn't see any violent behavior or any illegal behavior. So it's just ironic that the gap in reality between the reality of what law enforcement is seeing and the kind of surreal vision of what's going on that's being purveyed by the leadership of our universities is very ironic. And I will say, I haven't seen any evidence of any violence or anything other than, basic civil disobedience, clearly exercise of First Amendment rights, clearly within the law, really at Columbia or really anywhere. And I think we're in a situation now where the greatest threat is that we have, at Columbia, for example, thousands of armed police on the campus now for 3 more weeks. And I think that's a very dangerous situation because that alone can lead to violence. That alone can lead to provocation. And, you know, I hope that this period ends at Columbia without anything worse happening to the students.
Eleanor, it's really been illuminating to compare what happened those years ago and what's happening now on campuses. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, actually, I would suggest that the best way to follow what's going on is by watching Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, which is doing fantastic coverage and is featuring Juan Gonzalez, who is their co-host and who was a leader of the Columbia protest in 1968. So that would be my recommendation.
Well, unfortunately, Eleanor Stein, we've come to an end to our allotted time, so Heidi and I are going to have to say goodbye, but we truly appreciate your participation in Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Same to you. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you.